Chapter 12. Sis. She knew something was wrong when she went to slide her key into the big Krieg lock on her apartment door, and instead of slipping into the slot with its familiar and reassuring series of clicks, it pushed the door open instead. There was no moment of thinking how stupid she had been, going off to work and leaving her apartment door unlocked behind her. Gee, Miriam, why not just hang a note on the door that says, "Hello, robbers, I keep extra cash in the wok on the top kitchen shelf." There was no moment like that because once you'd been in New York 6 months, maybe even four, you didn't forget. Maybe you only locked up when you were going away on vacation if you lived in the sticks, and maybe you forgot to lock up once in a while when you went to work if you lived in a small city like Fargo, North Dakota, or Ames, Iowa. But after you'd been in the maggoty old Big Apple for a while, you locked up even if you were just taking a cup of sugar to a neighbor down the hall. Forgetting to lock up would be like exhaling a breath and just forgetting to take the next one. The city was full of museums and galleries, but the city was also full of junkies and psychos, and you didn't take chances. Not unless you had been born stupid, and Miriam had not been born that way. A little silly, maybe, but not stupid. So she knew something was wrong, and while the thieves Miriam was sure had broken into her apartment had probably left 3 or 4 hours ago, taking everything there was even a remote chance of hawking, not to mention the $80 or $90 in the wok, and maybe the wok itself, now that she thought of it. After all, was it not a hawkable wok? They could still be in there. It was the assumption you made anyway, just as boys who have received their first real guns are taught before they are taught anything else, to assume the gun is always loaded, that even when you take it out of the box in which it came from the factory, the gun is loaded. She began to step away from the door. She did this almost at once, even before the door had stopped its short inward swing, but it was already too late. A hand came out of the darkness, shooting through the 2-inch gap between door and jamb like a bullet. It clamped over her hand. Her keys dropped to the hall carpet. Miriam Cowley opened her mouth to scream. The big blonde man had been standing just inside the door, waiting patiently for just over 4 hours now, not drinking coffee, not smoking cigarettes. He wanted a cigarette and would have one as soon as this was over, but before, the smell might have alerted her. New Yorkers were like very small animals cowering in the underbrush, senses attuned for danger even when they thought they were having a good time. He had her right wrist in his right hand before she could even think. Now, he put the palm of his left hand against the door, bracing it, and yanked the woman forward just as hard as he could. The door looked like wood, but it was, of course, metal, as were all good apartment doors in the maggoty old Big Apple. The side of her face struck its edge with a thud. Two of her teeth broke off at the gum line and cut her mouth. Her lips, which had tightened, relaxed in shock, and blood spilled over the lower one. Droplets spattered on the door. Her cheekbones snapped like a twig. She sagged, semi-conscious. The blonde man released her. She collapsed to the hall carpet. This had to be very quick. According to New York folklore, no one in the maggoty old Big Apple gave a shit what went down, as long as it didn't go down on them. According to the folklore, a psycho could stab a woman 20 or 40 times outside of a 20-chair barbershop at high noon on 7th Avenue, and no one would say a thing except maybe, "Could you trim it a little higher over the ears?" Or, "I think I'll skip the cologne this time, Joe." The blonde man knew the folklore was false. For small hunted animals, curiosity is a part of the survival package. Protect your own skin, yes, that was the name of the game, but an incurious animal was apt to be a dead animal very soon. Therefore, speed was of the essence. He opened the door, seized Miriam by the hair, and yanked her inside. A bare moment later, he heard the snick of a deadbolt being released down the hall, followed by the click of an opening door. He didn't have to look out to see the face which would now be peering out of another apartment, a little hairless rabbit face, nose almost twitching. "You didn't break it, Miriam, did you?" he asked in a loud voice. He changed to a higher register, not quite falsetto, cupped both hands about 2 inches from his mouth to create a sound baffle, and became the woman.
"I don't think so. Can you help me pick it up?"
Removed his hands, reverted to his normal tone of voice. "Sure, just a sec." He closed the door and looked out through the peephole. It was a fisheye lens giving a distorted, wide-angle view of the corridor. and in it he saw exactly what he had expected to see. A white face peering around the edge of a door on the other side of the hall, peering like a rabbit looking out of its hole. The face retreated. The door shut. It did not slam shut, it simply swung shut. Silly Miriam had dropped something. The man with her, maybe a boyfriend, maybe her ex, was helping her pick it up. Nothing to worry about. All does and baby rabbits, as you were. Miriam was moaning, starting to come to. The blonde man reached into his pocket, brought out the straight razor, and shook it open. The blade gleamed in the dim glow of the only light he'd left on, a table lamp in the living room. Her eyes opened. She looked up at him, seeing his face upside down as he leaned over her. Her mouth was smeared red, as if she had been eating strawberries. He showed her the straight razor. Her eyes, which had been dazed and cloudy, came alert and opened wide. Her wet red mouth opened. "Make a sound, and I'll cut you, sis," he said, and her mouth closed. He wound a hand in her hair again and pulled her into the living room. Her skirt whispered on the polished wood floor. Her butt caught a throw rug and it snowplowed beneath her. She moaned in pain. "Don't do that," he said. "I told you." They were in the living room. It was small but pleasant. Cozy. French impressionist prints on the walls. A framed poster which advertised cats. "Now and forever," it said. Dried flowers. A small sectional sofa, upholstered in some nubby wheat-colored fabric. A bookcase. In the bookcase, he could see both of Beaumont's books on one shelf and all four of Stark's on another. Beaumont's were on a higher shelf. That was wrong, but he had to assume this bitch just didn't know any better. He let go of her hair. "Sit on the couch, sis. That end." He pointed at the end of the couch next to the little end table where the phone and the message recorder sat. "Please," she whispered, making no move to get up. Her mouth and cheek were beginning to swell up now, and the word came out mushy.
"Preesh. Anything. Everything. Money's in the wok.
Money's in the wok.
Sit on the couch. That end." This time he pointed the razor at her face with one hand, while he pointed at the couch with the other. She scrambled onto the couch and cringed as far into the cushions as they would allow, her dark eyes very wide. She swiped at her mouth with her hand and looked unbelievingly at the blood on her palm for a moment before looking back at him.
"What do you want? What do you want?"
It was like listening to someone talk through a mouthful of food. "I want you to make a phone call, sissy. That's all." He picked up the telephone and used the hand holding the straight razor long enough to thumb the announce button on the phone answering machine. Then he held the telephone handset out to her. It was one of the old-fashioned ones that sit in a cradle looking like a slightly melted dumbbell. Much heavier than the handset of a princess phone. He knew it, and saw from the subtle tightening of her body when he gave it to her that she knew it too. An edge of a smile showed on the blonde man's lips. It didn't show any place else, just on his lips. There was no summer in that smile.
"You're thinking you could brain me with that thing, aren't you, sis?"
he asked her.
"Let me tell you something. That's not a happy thought. And you know what happens to people who lose their happy thoughts, don't you?"
When she didn't answer, he said,
"They fall out of the sky. It's true. I saw it in a cartoon once. So you hold that telephone receiver in your lap and concentrate on getting your happy thoughts back."
She stared at him, all eyes. Blood ran slowly down her chin. A drop fell off and landed on the bodice of her dress. "Never get that out, sis," the blonde man thought. "They say you can get it out if you rinse the spot fast in cold water, but it isn't so. They have machines, spectroscopes, gas chromatographs, ultraviolet." Lady Macbeth was right.
"If that bad thought comes back, I'll see it in your eyes, sis. They're such big dark eyes. You wouldn't want one of those big dark eyes running down your cheek, would you?"
She shook her head so fast and hard her hair flew in a storm around her face. And all the time she was shaking her head, Those beautiful dark eyes never left his face, and the blond man felt a stirring along his leg. "Sir, do you have a folding ruler in your pocket, or are you just happy to see me?" This time the smile touched his eyes as well as his mouth, and he thought she relaxed just the tiniest bit. "I want you to lean forward and dial Thad Beaumont's number." She only gazed at him, her eyes bright and lustrous with shock. "Beaumont," he said patiently. "The writer. Do it, sis. Time fleets ever onward like the winged feet of Mercury."
"My book," she said.
Her mouth was now too swollen to close comfortably, and it was getting harder to understand her.
"I-ook,"
it sounded like.
"I-ook," he asked. "Is that anything like a sky hook?" "I don't know what you're talking about. Makes sense, sissy."
Carefully, painfully, enunciating.
"My book. Book. My address book. I don't remember his number."
The straight-edged razor slipped through the air toward her. It seemed to make a sound like a human whisper. That was probably just imagination, but both of them heard it, nevertheless. She shrank back even further into the wheat-colored cushions, swollen lips pulling into a grimace. He turned the razor so the blade caught the low, mellow light of the table lamp. He tipped it, let the light run along it like water, then looked at her as if they would both be crazy not to admire such a lovely thing. "Don't shit me, sis." Now there was a soft southern slur to his words. "That's one thing you never want to do, not when you're dealing with a fella like me. Now dial his motherfucking number." She might not have Beaumont's number committed to memory, not all that much business to do there, but she would have Stark's. In the book biz, Stark was your basic moving unit, and it just so happened the phone number was the same for both men. Tears began to spill out of her eyes.
"I don't remember,"
she moaned.
"I don't remember."
The blond man got ready to cut her, not because he was angry with her, but because when you let a lady like this get away with one lie, it always led to another, and then reconsidered. It was, he decided, perfectly possible that she had temporarily lost her grip on such mundane things as telephone numbers, even those of important clients like Beaumont Stark. She was in shock. If he had asked her to dial the number of her own agency, she might well have come up just as blank. But since it was Thad Beaumont and not Rick Cowley they were talking about, he could help. "Okay," he said. "Okay, sis, you're upset. I understand. I don't know if you believe this or not, but I even sympathize. And you're in luck because it just so happens I know the number myself. I know it as well as I know my own, you might say. And do you know what? I'm not even going to make you dial it, partly because I don't want to sit here until hell freezes over waiting for you to get it right, but also because I do sympathize. I'm going to lean over and dial it myself. Do you know what that means?" Miriam Cowley shook her head. Her dark eyes appeared to have eaten up most of her face. "It means I'm going to trust you, but only so far. Only just so far and no further, old girl. Are you listening? Are you getting all this?" Miriam nodded frantically, her hair flying. God, he loved a woman with a lot of hair. "Good, that's good. While I dial the phone, sis, you want to keep your eyes right on this blade. It will help you keep your happy thoughts in good order." He leaned forward and began to pick out the number on the old-fashioned rotary dial. Amplified clicking sounds came from the message recorder beside the phone as he did so. It sounded like a carny wheel of fortune slowing down. Miriam Cowley sat with the phone handset in her lap, looking alternately at the razor and the flat, crude planes of this horrible stranger's face. "Talk to him," the blond man said. "If his wife answers, tell her it's Miriam in New York and you want to talk to her man. I know your mouth is swollen, but make whoever answers know it's you. Put out for me, sis. If you don't want your face to wind up looking like a Picasso portrait, you put out for me just fine." The last two words came out, "just fine."
"What What do I say?
The blonde man smiled. She was a piece of work, all right. Mighty tasty. All that hair. More stirrings from the area below his belt buckle. It was getting lively down there. The phone was ringing. They could both hear it through the answering machine. You'll think of the right thing, sis. There was a click as the phone was picked up. The blonde man waited until he heard Beaumont's voice say hello, and then with the speed of a striking snake he leaned forward and drew the straight razor down Miriam Cowley's left cheek, pulling open a flap of skin there. Blood poured out in a freshet. Miriam shrieked. Hello, Beaumont's voice barked. Hello, who is this? God damn it, is it you? Yes, it's me, all right, you son of a bitch, the blonde man thought. It's me, and you know it's me, don't you? Tell him who you are and what's happening here, he barked at Miriam. Do it! Don't make me tell you twice. Who's that? Beaumont cried. What's going on? Who is this? Miriam shrieked again. Blood splattered on the wheat-colored sofa cushions. There wasn't just a single drop of blood on the bodice of her dress now. It was soaked. Do what I say or I'll cut your fucking head off with this thing.
There's a man here,
she screamed into the telephone. In her pain and terror, she was enunciating clearly again.
There's a bad man here, Thad. There's a bad man here.
Say your name,
he roared at her and sliced the straight razor through the air an inch in front of her eyes. She cringed back, wailing.
Who is this? Who? Miriam,
she shrieked.
Oh, Thad, don't let him cut me again. Don't let the bad man cut me again. Don't.
George Stark swept the straight razor through the kinked telephone cord. The phone machine uttered one angry bark of static and fell silent. It was good. It could have been better. He'd wanted to do her, really wanted to have it off with her. It had been a long time since he'd wanted to have it off with a woman, but he had wanted this one, and he wasn't going to get her. There'd been too much screaming. The rabbits would be poking their heads out of their holes again, scenting the air for the big predator that was padding around somewhere in the jungle just beyond the glow of their pitiful little electric campfires. She was still shrieking. It was clear she had lost all her happy thoughts. So Stark grabbed her by the hair again, bent her head back until she was staring at the ceiling, shrieking at the ceiling, and cut her throat. The room fell silent.
There, sis, he said tenderly.
He folded the straight razor back into its handle and put it into his pocket. Then he reached out his bloody left hand and closed her eyes. The cuff of his shirt was immediately soaked in warm blood because her jugular was still pumping the claret, but the proper thing to do was the proper thing to do. When it was a woman, you closed her eyes. It didn't matter how bad she had been. It didn't matter if she was a junkie whore who had sold her own kids to buy dope. You closed her eyes. And she was only a small part of it. Rick Cowley was a different story. And the man who had written the magazine piece. And the bitch who had taken the pictures, especially that one of the tombstone. A bitch, yes, a right bitch. But he would close her eyes, too. And when they were all taken care of, it would be time to talk to Thad himself. No intermediaries. Mano a mano. Time to make Thad see reason. After he had done all of them, he fully expected Thad to be ready to see reason. If he wasn't, there were ways to make him see it. He was, after all, a man with a wife. A very beautiful wife. A veritable queen of air and darkness. And he had kids. He held his forefinger in the warm jet of Miriam's blood and quickly began to print on the wall. He had to go back twice in order to get enough, but the message was up there in short order, printed above the woman's lolling head. She could have read it upside down if her eyes had been open. And, of course, if she had still been alive. He leaned forward and kissed Miriam's cheek. Good night, sissy, he said, and left the apartment. The man across the hall was looking out his door again. When he saw the tall, blood-smeared blonde man emerge from Miriam's apartment, he slammed the door and locked it. Wise, George Stark thought, striding down the hall toward the elevator. Very fucking wise. Meantime, he had to be moving along. He had no time to linger. There was other business to take care of tonight.